President Rouhani says that Iran is the only party to the 2015 nuclear deal that has paid for keeping the accord alive, but things cannot go on like this. Yemen's Ansarullah forces and their allies make advances on Nahrir province to liberate it from Saudi-backed militants. The U.S. Senate passes a huge coronavirus relief plan as the country struggles to tackle the economic fallout of the pandemic. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, President Hassan Rouhani has urged Europe to put an end to its inaction regarding the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani issued the call as he met with Ireland's foreign minister, Simon Coveney, in Tehran. Coveney is visiting Iran as a UN Security Council facilitator of the nuclear deal signed by the Islamic Republic and six world powers. Rouhani said that the accord will be reactivated once the U.S. lifts the sanctions on Iran and all parties keep their sides of the bargain. He said that Iran is the only party that has paid for keeping the deal alive, but things cannot continue like this. Coveney called the 2018 U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal a historic mistake. He said that the new administration of the White House is determined to re-enter the accord. Pope Francis has started his tour of northern Iraq on the final leg of his historic visit to the country. He began his tour with a visit to the city of Erbil. He then went to Mosul, the former stronghold of the Daesh terror group in Iraq. Security has been tightened in Mosul, where the Pope will lead a prayer for the victims of war. He will be back in Erbil on Sunday afternoon when he will celebrate Mass. Pope Francis began his trip to Iraq on Friday, marking the first papal visit to the country. He has met with the Iraqi top Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. The two sides have called for peace. Three Palestinian fishermen have been killed after an explosion hit their boat off the Gaza Strip. A correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, has the details.
When the bodies of the three fishermen arrived at the hospital, the officials there said that the fishermen were hit by an explosive device, possibly fired by the Israeli gunboats that patrolled the sea off the coast of the Gaza Strip. There were other incidents this today by Israeli gunboats firing at Palestinian fishermen over the past. Decade or so, Israel have killed over 2 dozen Palestinian fishermen and injured thousands more. Palestinian fishermen come almost on a daily basis under attacks by the Israeli military that keeps the Gaza Strip under a tight aerial land and naval blockade since 2007. We're still waiting for more details on what happened this morning off the coast of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. But so far, the Israeli military denied that it attacked the boats. Palestinian fishermen not only suffer from the Israeli naval attacks, but sometimes they also come under attacks by the Egyptian Navy as well.
Yemen's Ansarullah forces and their allied army units have made advances on the Nahrir governorate to liberate it from Saudi-backed militants. Military sources say that Ansarullah and its allies are just several kilometers from Nahrir city and are close to liberating it. The Nahrir governorate is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed militants in Yemen. Ansarullah and its allies began their operations to free the city last month. Almost 100 people have reportedly been killed on both sides. Based on reports, Saudi Arabia has dispatched more troops to Marib to help the militants there. At the same time, Al-Qaeda terrorists are providing them with assistance, that according to Yemeni intelligence. Saab Shath is an author and a Middle East affairs expert, and he says that the terrorists operating in Yemen are backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States and are seeking to prolong the war.
We've seen reports from the beginning of the conflict of Al-Qaeda being placed in an area controlled by Emirates forces in the south and in the north of Yemen, close enough to the north of Yemen, with the support of the Saudis as well. And the Americans are very much aware of all of this. But since Ma'rib is a major front now, and the collapsing of Ma'rib means practically the end of the Saudi occupation in most of Yemen, that means Al-Qaeda have to act quick, because that means as well the elimination of Al-Qaeda from Yemen. These Al-Qaeda forces in Yemen and the other militants, it's another face of to the Saudis, Zionist and American supported occupation in Yemen.
The U.S. Senate has passed a major rescue plan put forth by the administration to help revive the economy during the COVID pandemic.
The yeas are 50, the nays are 49. Bill as amended is passed.
The party line vote saw no Republicans voting for the $1.9 trillion package. Stripping legislation now heads back to the House of Representatives. The Democratic majority chamber is expected to adopt the relief package, making it one of the largest stimulus plans in U.S. history. President Joe Biden has hailed approval as a giant step toward reviving America's pandemic-stricken economy.
When we took office 45 days ago, I promised the American people that help was on the way. Today, I can say we've taken one more giant step forward in delivering on that promise that help was on the way. This plan puts us on a path to beating the virus. This plan gives those families who are struggling the most the help and the breathing room they need to get through this moment. This plan gives small businesses in this country a fighting chance to survive.
The legislation would send out $1,400 stimulus checks to most Americans. It allocates $350 billion to state and local governments. The bill also provides $49 billion for COVID testing and another $14 billion for vaccine distribution. The coronavirus pandemic has left more than 500,000 people dead out of 29 million cases in the U.S. A professor of economics, Steve Kane, believes that more should have been done to help the Americans through the pandemic.
It's certainly good that it's been done. More should have been done, because the real impact of the COVID on the average working American is that their cash flow has dried up, but their financial commitments still remain. So if you look at what that's meant to households in America, everybody's focusing on a so-called increase in the savings rate. That is actually just an artifact of the definition of savings as output minus consumption, where consumption has fallen more than output. But the actual level of household debt in America has risen by about 4 or 5% of GDP. So households are borrowing money just simply to keep on paying their bills. And this will go some way towards addressing that, but not the full distance.
Now, in Paraguay, President Mario Abdo Benitez has announced a cabinet reshuffle amid unrest over his government's COVID response.
As president, my job is to serve our people. I'm aware that people are hoping for change, and I'm going to make them. That is why I have informed the entire cabinet that they will be relieved of their posts in the coming hours. Decrees for new appointments will be published.
Benitez called for greater participation and dialogue to correct mistakes. He also condemned acts of violence. The president has faced calls to step down over his response to the pandemic. People hit the streets of the capital Asuncion on Friday, blaming him for worsening the situation. Security forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas to break up the rally. Several people were injured. Paraguay's COVID crisis has forced the resignation of the health minister. The country has reported 166,000 COVID cases and 3,200 deaths, the vaccination program has been hampered by delays in the arrival of jabs. France has extended weekend lockdowns to its northern parts as it's struggling to contain the virus outbreak. The measure now puts more than 2 million people across France under the weekend restrictions. The pandemic has killed 88,300 people across the country. That's one of the highest death tolls in Europe. In some countries, COVID restrictions brought people to the streets. In the Austrian capital, protesters demanded the resignation of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz. Many of them were not wearing masks, nor did they observe social distancing. In Sweden, people rallied in the capital in defiance of a government ban on large gatherings. Six police officers were injured in scuffles with the ralliers. A shipment of more than 250,000 AstraZeneca vaccines destined for Australia has been blocked from leaving the European Union. Big pharmaceutical companies are being pressured to honor their contracts as frustration is growing across the bloc. The vaccine rollout is going very slowly and supply is dwindling.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia. But nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies. And additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received its first shipment of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, as another surge of the virus races across the country.
By next week, Hungary will be the most vaccinated country within the European Union. But even this pace is not fast enough to prevent the spread of the virus and especially its new variants.
The EU is only using Western-approved vaccines at the moment. Europe's drug regulator has launched a review of Russia's Sputnik V, which has an efficacy of 91.6%, insisting geopolitics is not affecting decision-making.
I would like to say very clearly, EMA undertakes its analysis of a vaccine based on health-related criteria related to the safety and the efficacy of the vaccine. Full stop. There is no other consideration than that. And therefore, geopolitics have nothing to do with the fact that you consider that EMA would consider a vaccine safe and efficacious or not. It's based on the assessment of the vaccine.
Russia says it is ready to provide jabs for 50 million Europeans the moment it gets the green light. Vaccine rollouts will only work if they happen fast and evenly across continents, outsmarting mutations. Amid a surge of cases across the whole of Europe, the EU has launched a continent-wide project to strip out supply bottlenecks and boost production, hoping to redeem itself and stave off a third wave. Bianca Rahimi, London.
China says its exports recorded their fastest annual growth in over two decades during the January-February period. Customs data shows exports jumped by more than 60% in the first 2 months of the year compared to a year earlier. The surge is fueled by a rebound in foreign demand, and that comes as manufacturing gets back on its feet in major economies, including the U.S. and the EU. Economic activity in China was battered by the coronavirus pandemic early in 2020, and that led outbound trade to nosedive by 17%. China has largely weathered the pandemic ever since. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says that growing demand in the U.S. for Chinese goods has helped boost China's exports.
Remember, we're starting with from a very low base. This year, this period last year, 2020, the deficit with the U.S. in terms of imports was about $7 billion, and total surplus, I should say, was $7 billion. This 2 month period, it's over $100 billion. So it's due to last, obviously, China shut down. But on the other side, China produces a tremendous number of intermediate goods and also essential goods. You know, you have to have clothing, you have to have shoes, you have to replace furniture. And there's a lot of intermediate parts that go into U.S. Production. So as the U.S. ramps up, its appetite for Chinese components increases. So this will continue as long as the economy starts to build in other parts of the world and as long as people need PPE and other things.
Now in Pakistan, Prime Minister Imran Khan has been able to secure the backing of parliament after his government suffered a shocking defeat in the recent Senate election. 178 voted in his favor. That's 6 more than the required number for him to remain prime minister. Kamran Yusuf reports.
A sigh of relief for the Pakistani Prime Minister. The country's National Assembly reposed trust in Prime Minister Imran Khan in a vote of confidence. Prime Minister Khan himself sought the vote of confidence from the National Assembly after the government-backed candidate lost to an opposition leader in a Senate election. The defeat of the country's finance minister had raised questions whether the government commanded majority of the parliament. After winning the vote of confidence, Prime Minister Khan made it clear that he would not give any relief to opposition leaders facing corruption cases.
Mr. Zardari has been proven corrupt. He is known as Mr. 10%. On the other hand, Nawaz Sharif, after plundering the national wealth, has fled abroad. I will not give them any amnesty, come what may.
While inside the parliament, members were congratulating the Prime Minister, outside, government and opposition members were clashing with each other. The ruling party workers attacked the senior opposition leaders when they were holding press conference. Opposition parties condemned the violence.
We are proud of our leaders for fighting back against war thieves and thugs like lions. The government lost its sense and mind after facing humiliating defeats one after the other and from every side.
But Prime Minister Khan's supporters were jubilant for his success.
These people have not come here on Prime Minister Imran Khan's call. He has not given any official call. These are people who came here spontaneously. We decided ourselves. It's a grassroots movement. We decided that we'll come here to show our support for Imran Khan.
While Khan's supporters defend his performance, opposition thinks the country's economic situation has deteriorated under the current government.
Prime Minister Imran Khan may have won the vote of confidence from the parliament, but observers believe his trouble is far from over. Amid economic and other challenges, major opposition parties are planning to march towards the capital later this month to seek his ouster. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Well, that's it for me for this part of the broadcast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
مجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The characteristics of Tabriz and Azerbaijan. Sometimes a person only joins a movement, and sometimes a person creates an orientation and causes a development, and they influence its formation and its continuation. Tabriz and Azerbaijan are like this. In the era when the late Mirza Shirazi issued the famous tobacco fatwa against the attempt by colonial powers to monopolize Iranian tobacco, the late Haji Mirza Jawad Mujtahid, an outstanding scholar in Tabriz, whose family is well known for introducing Mujtahids, was an influential personality. Well, at that time, Mirza Shirazi was in Samarra. If it had not been for the scholars in Iran, figures such as Mirza Ashtiani in Tehran, Haji Mirza Jawad Mujtahid in Tabriz, and other ulama in other cities, that fatwa would not have become comprehensive and would not have produced the desired effect. In Azerbaijan, the late Haji Mirza Jawad entered the arena in an active manner. The same is true of the constitutional era. Later on, I will expand on this matter. Therefore, in the historic and political developments of the country, generally, Azerbaijan and especially Tabriz created a wave of influential orientations.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The next point is that Azerbaijan was Iran's strong fortress against foreign attacks. We were always subject to attacks launched by aggressive neighbors, Tsarist Russia, the former Ottoman Empire and former Soviet Union. If it had not been for Azerbaijan and Tabriz, and for their resistance, steadfastness and sacrifices, it would have been possible for those attacks to be drawn into the central areas of the country. Azerbaijan has been a strong dam and fortress which has always repelled and frustrated those attacks.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises.
Joe Biden's first military action as President of the United States was to bomb Syria, cementing himself as another warmonger in the Oval Office. The claim that these strikes were defensive in nature is an absurdity coming from an occupying force, which most seem to gloss over. This was a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territory and another act of imperialist aggression. So let's break this down. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On February 25th, 2021, the United States bombed the Syrian Arab Republic. The airstrikes took place on the border between Iraq and Syria, around Abu Kamal, located in the Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, four were wounded and one person was martyred. Shortly after the attack, the Pentagon released a statement saying, quote, at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces earlier this evening conducted airstrikes against infrastructure utilized by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. These strikes were authorized in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq and to ongoing threats to those personnel. Specifically, the strikes destroyed multiple facilities located at a border control point used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups, unquote. So this statement claims that these strikes were defensive, which is an absurdity in of itself. Syria has not bombed the United States or declared war on the United States. Syria is on the other side of the planet. The United States has no business being in Syria. Moreover, the claim that they were meant for de-escalation simply does not compute. Bombing another country is tantamount to a declaration of war, not de-escalation. China, Venezuela, Iran all condemned the attack, and Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, strongly condemned the bombing and called for unconditional respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria, which should not be used to settle geopolitical scores. So according to the Biden administration, this attack on Syria was a response by the United States to recent attacks on its personnel. Now, it's widely assumed by the media that what they're referring to is a rocket attack that took place on February 15th in Erbil in Iraq, where an American contractor was killed. Six others were wounded, including an American soldier. And in another instance on February 22nd, when a rocket landed inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. This is where the U.S. Embassy is located, the biggest embassy in the world, almost the size of Vatican City, which looks more like a military installation than anything else. So while the United States claims it's defending itself and responding to rocket attacks, it conveniently leaves out the obvious that the United States is in Iraq illegally. It illegally invaded Iraq in 2003, along with Britain. The U.S.-led coalition has no right to be in Iraq in the first place, nor in Syria for that matter. So you can't talk about defending yourself when you are the aggressor, when you are the oppressor, when you are illegally on someone else's land. You're not defending yourself when you're on someone else's land, you are attacking. Moreover, the United States has imposed crippling sanctions on Iran, which are indeed a form of siege warfare. It assassinated General Soleimani. It has violated Iran's sovereignty numerous times. But the U.S. is not officially at war with Iran, so why is it bombing Iranian-backed militias? Is that supposed to make it okay? When the U.S. talks of Iranian-backed militias, what they really mean are the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMU, or in Arabic, the Hashd al-Sha'bi. These are not Iranian troops. They're a popular resistance movement made up of various local ethnic religious groups, which include Shia, Sunni, Christians, Druze, but fought very hard to defeat Daesh and to resist occupation. But of course, the United States can't speak of them as a popular resistance because then people would rightfully wonder, what are they resisting? And this would expose the United States and their allies as illegal occupiers, as an invading force, which has no right to be there in the first place. As long as a Pentagon official or a stenographer for the White House says Iran or Iranian-backed militias, that's all it takes for everyone's brains to suddenly shut down and just accept that Joe Biden is bombing another sovereign nation. First of all, whether Iran has troops or militias, as they say in Syria, or the other way around, this is a matter between Iran and Syria. The United States has no right to interfere in the eternal politics, alliances, partnerships, and cooperations between those two countries. Would the United States accept it if, for example, Syria bombed Korea for having an American base there? Of course not. So this is not a valid argument. Syria is a sovereign nation, Iran is a sovereign nation, Iraq is a sovereign nation. But of course, this is of no concern to the Americans and British who have colonized the region for centuries, plundering and stealing resources and meddling in the region's political affairs. Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds force, along with Abu Mahdi, a senior commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the PMU. Now, Joe Biden bombs the PMU inside Syria. Both these actions only serve to help Daesh. And this wouldn't be the first time, of course, that the United States and its military actions, whether purposely or not, end up helping Daesh seeking to take over Syria and Iraq. In 2016, U.S. warplanes killed 62 Syrian troops in an airstrike and wounded more than 100. These troops were directly involved in the fight against Daesh. Again, in 2018, the U.S. bombed Syrian and Russian troops inside Syria, which only serves to help the foreign-backed terrorists which they were fighting in the first place. But on top of that, they're not only benefiting Daesh with these actions, Israel is at the very least very sure to be happy about Biden's decision to bomb Syria. After all, for years, Israel has been routinely bombing Syria almost on a weekly basis, taking advantage of the fact that Syria is crippled by war and sanctions. And usually Israel almost never admits to the illegal assassinations or bombings that it carries out on other nations and governments. But Israeli officials have previously confirmed that they have carried out hundreds, if not over 1,000 airstrikes on Syria in the last decade alone. And seeing how close Israel and the United States are in their shared interests, it's not surprising, of course, that Joe Biden uses the exact same pretext. Joining me now to talk more about Biden's airstrikes on Syria is Max Abrams, Associate Professor of Political Science at Northeastern University and fellow at the Quincy Institute. Thanks for taking the time, Professor. Appreciate having you on.
Happy to be on your show.
So, Professor, in 2018, Donald Trump bombed Syria over the alleged chemical gas attacks in Douma. Now, the OPCW scandal, that's an entire story in of itself, but I want to focus on the contrast in reaction here. At the time, Democrats like AOC and Kamala Harris rebuked Trump, citing the illegality of the strikes, yet now they're mostly silent on Biden. So there's a bit of a double standard going on here in the reaction from the media and Democrats. Would you agree with that assessment?
I see what you're saying, and I could definitely go that route. I have seen what you're describing, which is apparent hypocrisy by Kamala Harris talking about illegality, Syrian sovereignty, and now she's the vice president, and there's doesn't seem to be any respect for Syrian sovereignty. That said, I see more continuity than differences, because although Trump, was very reviled in the American public, especially in the media, one of the very few things he ever did in his whole life that was celebrated in the aggregate was attacking Syria. You'll remember that Fareed Zakaria said after he authorized the strike, congratulations, Donald Trump, it's like your first day as president. You've finally become a real president. And so if you want to be popular, regardless of whether you're on the American political left or right, with the exception of the fringes, but sort of mainstream left, mainstream right, yeah, attack Iran, attack Syria, people will quibble, but in general, there is political value for that decision making.
Speaking of continuity, Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, and Abu Mahdi, senior commander in the PMU, which were hit just now in the airstrike by Biden. Would you say there's continuity in that and their general policy towards Iran? And who stands to benefit the most here exactly? Because, whether the United States calls them Iranian-backed militias or not, the PMU have still contributed enormously in the fight against Daesh, against ISIS. So who's benefiting the most from what just took place exactly?
You're quite right that when Trump authorized the killing of Soleimani, that was depicted as controversial in the United States, and he was criticized by Democrats, whereas clearly under Biden, we are seeing a continuity of targeted killing. And so there is hypocrisy there. With respect to who benefits, I think that one of the beneficiaries is Israel. I think that Israel, its greatest threat, according to Israeli officials, is this, it's described as a land bridge from Tehran to Beirut, particularly this axis, the Iranian government and the Iranian militia groups all the way into the Levant. So I think that Israel recognizes that the Biden administration is not as categorically, reflexively pro-Israel as the Biden administration was. Now, don't get me wrong. I still expect the Biden administration to be very pro-Israel, but not to the same degree as Trump was. You know, they name towns and things after Trump. I'm not sure they're going to do that with Biden. So a lot of people, the conventional wisdom in the American media was that Biden was sending a signal to Iran. I actually think that the signal was to Israel more, saying we're not going to tolerate this kind of land bridge. And even though there was this delay from Biden contacting Netanyahu, don't worry, the Biden administration is going to look out for Israel, just as Trump did. I think that probably the attack doesn't really surprise Iran all that much, and probably doesn't fundamentally affect U.S.-Iranian relations. I think that it's not a significant, in the history books, this will not be registered as an event in terms of that important bilateral relationship. I do think that the media has done a very bad job, an intentionally bad job, in describing the relationship between Iran and ISIS. The American media likes to downplay the fact that Iran has been not only at odds with ISIS, but one of ISIS's primary enemies, especially on the ground. And that was true both in Iraq as well as in Syria. There's an inverse relationship between them and ISIS. And so there is a concern that if Iran were continued to be attrited, as well as Russia, which has also been deeply maligned, of course, in the American media in all sorts of ways, but especially with respect to its relationship to Salafi jihadists, that could create the kind of space for ISIS and al-Qaeda and affiliated jihadists to grow.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, one thing I'm not seeing talked a lot about in the media is how this is going to affect the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. What do you think will happen there, specifically when the Biden administration says they're open to more talks with European partners, although Iran says it wants sanctions lifted first? Do you think these strikes are going to affect the Iran nuclear deal and diplomatic endeavors in any way?
As you and your guests very well know, under Biden, the Obama administration really helped to broker the Iran nuclear deal. And so when Trump effectively destroyed it, and then Biden would get elected, one would think that, particularly because the nuclear deal was cast as Obama and Biden's one of their biggest, most important foreign policy legacies, you would expect them to just continue forward and to do whatever it takes to jumpstart this deal, which they were highly critical of Trump for derailing. But they haven't done that, actually. You know, they've added all these additional hoops. Who's going to go first? You know, is there going to be relief? You know, is the nuclear deal going to be fundamentally changed? Are they going to add provisions to it? Are they going to include more features, like with respect to rockets and support for militant groups? All of this kind of talk increases the odds that the nuclear deal will not be recommenced. And so it is a little bit surprising how tepid they are in pushing this negotiation forward. So there seems to be a lack of clarity and a lack of bravery from this administration. And I think that we see that in the Iran nuclear deal.
How about Democrats actually doing anything to limit the scope of the AUMF? Do you see anything happening there? You know, supposedly since they control the House and the Senate barely. I kind of already know the answer, but go ahead.
It'll be interesting to see how much this administration can moderate sort of its inclination, which is to get increasingly involved in the region at a time when the American public is turning away. I think that the administration is simply going to reframe and recast some of the same behaviors, but in different terms. So we see a continuation of the use of American military force and intervention, but there's a real emphasis by the Biden team to say that it's defensive in nature. We've seen this with the weapons going to Yemen. They are defensive. You know, we see the U.S. Attacking supposedly Iranian targets on the Syrian border, and it's defensive. So I think that there's a real sort of PR effort to present the United States as good guys, even if the U.S. will continue to liberally use military force, including probably to promote its freedom agenda, which it knows has taken on a negative connotation. And so perhaps that won't be as much of an emphasis as, for example, under the George W. Bush administration, when neoconservatives would just exclaim very loudly that our goal is to promote democracy throughout the region.
Max Abrams, thanks so much for your valuable insight. It's really a pleasure speaking with you and having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to come on anytime.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
At the end of the day, we really get to see once again how Biden and his policies are just a continuation of the same old. As a matter of fact, they're almost indistinguishable from those of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Donald Trump puts sanctions on Syria, Biden keeps them. Donald Trump steals Syria's oil, Biden also steals Syria's oil. Trump builds illegal bases in Syria, Biden keeps them and builds more illegal bases in Syria. Trump bombs Syria in 2018, Biden also bombs Syria in 2021. That's not the lesser of two evils, that's precisely the same evil continued. When Trump imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria in June 2020, we all knew that civilians would be hurt the most, that people would starve in a country already ravaged by a decade of war. Joe Biden, who people call the lesser of two evils, was he going to reverse this? Of course not. Secretary of State Blinken, who's his foreign policy advisor at the time during the campaign, told the Washington Post that Biden thought the sanctions were a very important tool. These sanctions have crushed the lira, the Syrian pound. Syrians are forming bread lines in a country that once used to be self-sufficient and a net exporter of wheat. Within days of Biden taking office, we saw a convoy of U.S. trucks illegally cross over from Iraq into Syria through the El Walid border crossing, as they always do, on their way to steal more oil. The Syrian permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar al-Jafari, warned Joe Biden, quote, "The new U.S. administration must stop acts of aggression and occupation, plundering the wealth of my country, withdraw its occupying forces from it, and stop supporting separatist militias, illegal entities, and attempts to threaten Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity." Of course, Joe Biden has done no such thing. And despite a statement by the Pentagon that their priority isn't the oil, Biden still has U.S. troops building bases in Syria illegally, occupying Syria's oil fields illegally. And just like Trump bombed Syria, now we see Biden bombing Syria, although not over chemical weapons, but another one of the media's favorite boogeymen, the so-called Iranian-backed militias. You know, at least in 2018, Kamala Harris, who's now the vice president, rebuked Trump, saying she's deeply concerned about the legal rationale of the strikes. Really? She's concerned about the legal rationale of such strikes? That's wonderful. I really hope she maintains that same attitude towards Joe Biden, although I highly doubt she will. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called Trump a mad king who decided to, quote, bomb a nation without the constitutional requirement of congressional approval. And yet, unlike 2018, suspiciously, AOC is nowhere to be found right now. She's been completely silent on Joe Biden's airstrikes on Syria. With the exception of Ilhan Omar, she correctly pointed out how outrageous the AUMF is because of the sweeping powers that it gives the president. Fundamentally, you know, we still don't see any mention of actual consequences. Where's the plan to get rid of the AUMF? Where are the consequences for Joe Biden's actions in violating his oath of office and bombing a sovereign nation? We're not hearing any of it. They're all quiet. You know, I'm sure the American people are so happy to see that one of Joe Biden's first accomplishments in office has been to bomb Syria. Americans, the very same Americans who have yet to see any of those relief checks they were promised, which were originally $2,000, now reduced to $1,400. The same Americans who were told they can't have a minimum wage, a $15 minimum wage through budget reconciliation, even though Biden said it would be a top priority and made it one of the pillars of his campaign. The same Americans who were told no more kids in cages, which also turned out to be a lie. The kids are no longer separated from their parents, perhaps, but they're still locked up in nicer-looking cages with air conditioners. The same Americans that were told the erratic Donald Trump would be defeated and replaced with Biden, who would restore the soul of the nation and dignity to the White House. It seems Americans were told a lot of things, a lot of nice things, and not just by Biden's campaign, but even by intellectuals and scholars that claimed he would be less dangerous than Trump. Well, as far as Syria is concerned, that's nonsense. But it's okay, though, because remember, at least now there's diversity. Remember, you were promised diversity and unity by the Biden administration? So now you have Lloyd Austin, the first black man to lead the Pentagon, who also happens to be a former board member for Raytheon, the weapons manufacturer. Or the fact that Kamala Harris is the first Asian-American and female vice president. Or Avril Haines, the first woman to be director of national intelligence. Now that makes everything okay. Just put a bunch of rainbows on the bombs and everything will be okay, right? Of course, the neocons and proponents of the war on terror will tell you that Biden does have the right to do military strikes on other nations under the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF, which was signed into law in 2001, 2002, giving a carte blanche, a blank check for the Bush administration and every administration since to invade other countries, order drone strikes and assassinations, and run wild with any foreign policy decision they please. Many have rightfully criticized the AUMF and have called it constitutional for the sweeping powers that it gives the commander-in-chief, who can effectively bypass Congress and go behind its back to attack other countries. But even if the entire U.S. Congress had okayed this imperialist attack on Syria, that would still not make it okay. The U.S. Congress is not the world police. Its decrees are not universal and absolute. Biden's airstrikes on Syria are first and foremost a violation of international law. The United States has no right to attack a sovereign nation and another member of the United Nations. This clearly violates the United Nations Charter, specifically Article 2.4, which says that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. But of course, it's not about laws, it's about language, it's about PR. So under Trump, the kids in cages, that's called concentration camps. But under Biden, they're migrant overflow facilities. And when Trump bombs Syria, they decry him as a mad king, but when Biden does, they're defensive airstrikes. You know, let's just go ahead and remove the word imperialism from the dictionary. Let's replace it with Biden's unity slogan instead, shall we? So while Biden's administration claims it's more diverse, let's be frank with each other here. There's no diversity in terms of policy. You know, he can paint as many transgender flags and put as many Black Lives Matter decals on the bombs as he wants, but these are the same imperialist tactics, the same imperialist agenda used by every president before him. This is just a furthering of America's imperialist interests and its neocon behavior, which the U.S. has been carrying out in the Middle East for the past decades, crippling Syria, crippling Syria's allies, being hawks on Iran, continuing to occupy Iraq illegally. That's what it comes down to, and there's no difference there. So to claim diversity, this means absolutely nothing for the people who are under those bombs when they fall. As a matter of fact, it means nothing for Americans, who are also being given the short end of the stick and robbed of their own wealth so that the military-industrial complex, the weapons manufacturers, and private corporations can make tons of money and build swimming pools for themselves while they starve. That's what it comes down to. There's no diversity there. But in moments like these, I think it's very important to look back at history, right? Damascus, the capital of Syria, where I was born, is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. It's thousands of years old. Many civilizations, many empires have tried to capture Syria. Many foreign invaders and their armies have tried to take the Middle East and claim Syria as their own. But none of them last forever. Look around Syria and you will find nothing but the ruins of those very empires who thought they would last forever. As history shows us, every dog has their day. Every empire rises and every empire falls. But Syria always remains. Inshallah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Effects of Sin. It is proved today that the cause of most physical diseases lie in spiritual and emotional factors. And one of the most important causes of mental diseases is the heavy pressures imposed on man's soul by his conscience. A sinner is judged in the court of conscience and suffers painful spiritual punishments and its reactions. And those reactions are manifested in the body and soul in the form of diseases and even death. On the contrary, the beneficent people are encouraged by their conscience, and the spiritual encouragement empowers them and makes them cheerful and increases their lifespan. Hence, sins shortens life and beneficence prolongs it. Brothers and sisters, there are several effects of sins in our lives. You know, of course, the reward and the heaven and the paradise and hell, all of that is a reality and it is there. But even within this physical realm, in this world, we see the effects of sins on our lifespans. Somebody who sins, their lifespan typically is shorter than those who do not sin and who are careful in how they lead their lives. So remember that not only the spiritual effects of sin are harmful, but even their physical, the physical impact and effects of sin are seriously harmful for every human being. Hence, Islam has refrained us from carrying out sinful actions. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the effects of sin, and we said that there are spiritual effects of sin, but at the same time there are physical effects of sin in this very world. We're not talking about another world at the moment. We're talking about this very world that we live in. Sins are harmful for us even in this world. Hence, Islam has asked us and has prescribed for us to refrain from any sins. Now, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth infallible Imam, has said, "Those who die as a result of sin are more than those who die due to natural death. And those who have a long life as a result of beneficence are more than those who have a long life due to natural life." So see how the infallible Imam is also informing us the adverse effects of sins. Imam is informing that not only in the hereafter you're going to have to face the consequences of sinning, but also in this very world you will have to face those adverse effects. Now, there are, you know, many adverse effects of sinning, we know that. We're going to discuss like very briefly one of them, which is that sinning shortens a person's lifespan. A person may live long, but if it's in a sinful way, then their life is devoid of Allah's blessings. The longevity of life is not superior to the purpose of existence. In a period of heedlessness, You might think you are living the life. However, what is this life if not utilized in servitude to the one who gave you life? So be subservient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, refrain from all types of sins, and remember that there are not only spiritual adverse effects of sinning, but you have to face those adverse effects in this life as well. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Nigerian government has described the commencement of this vaccination exercise of Nigerians as a historic moment in the fight against the COVID-19. The kickoff of the vaccination followed the delivery of close to 4 million doses of the COVAX AstraZeneca vaccines to Nigeria on 2nd March 2021. Nigerian health officials said the delay in the start of the vaccination was to ensure that the vaccines were checked for safety.
The vaccines that we're going to be delivering today to Nigerians are safe, they're effective, and we're going to roll out this vaccine in a very efficient manner, just like we all work together as one country and defeated the white polio viruses. Today, it feels proud to be a Nigerian. All of you should be proud.
The Nigerian government said Nigerians should support the planned and systematic rollout of the vaccines and mobilize citizens for the vaccination exercise. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, played an important role in the arrival of the vaccines and says the successful battle against the COVID-19 will impact positively on routine immunization of Nigerian children against the other preventable childhood killer diseases.
UNICEF was the organization that did the procurement and the delivery of those vaccines on the 2nd of March. And we're very, very pleased that today we're able to administer them. But also now the challenge is getting them to the states, and the states starting to vaccinate the frontline workers, the health workers, so that they can be protected as quickly as is possible.
This medical doctor becomes the first Nigerian at this occasion to be given the COVID-19 vaccination. He has been a frontline health worker since March 2020 and has lost his father to the COVID-19. 158,000 Nigerians have so far been infected with the COVID-19, and over 1,900 have died of the disease. The World Health Organization has stated that the vaccines have undergone rigorous regulatory processes at global and country level and have been certified safe and effective. The next challenge for Nigerian health officials is how to reach millions of Nigerians in remote rural communities. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Anti-monarchy activists showed up at the headquarters of Spain's car manufacturer SEAT in the north of Barcelona to protest the visit by King Felipe and Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. Protesters shouted slogans against the monarch and held banners reading "Catalonia has no king," 1 week after violent riots shook the region over the imprisonment of a rapper for insulting Spanish royals.
The rejection of the Spanish monarchy has become a recurrent theme with every royal visit to Catalonia over the past years.